Tyler. Jordan. Fredo. Jameer. Dylan.
Someone's bag's back there. I don't know whose it is. David. I know you're David. Elise. Nathan. Manuel. So.
I'll say it again. I get it that history is not everyone's bag. Get it. I understand. Because it's hard. It's not like math, where you can use a little app on your phone and you can do 2 + 2 = 4. History requires attention. History. History requires focus. History requires reading and studying and analyzing. But out of history, one can learn lessons, especially if you're paying attention to what's going on. Now, you can put your head in the sand and just be naive and disconnected all you want. But what you're going to end up running into are problems. Problems that could be avoidable. Because if you are paying attention and looking around, you will see that human beings have been the same since the beginning of a recorded time, and human beings have a tendency to do the same stupid stuff over and over again because we're human beings. Well, if you're paying attention to history, you can look back in history and say, oh, look what they did. And then you have the ability to sit back and ask, how did that happen? Why did they do that? What mistakes did they make? And if you are clever, you will sit back and say, yeah, I don't want to do it. And you will avoid those mistakes. Well, beginning in the 1840s, the Europeans were using their economic dominance to essentially take control of every open square acre of land on Earth. They weren't sending in massive armies and conquering and perpetrating genocide. We know how they did it. They would go in and make a deal with the leader. And the tribal leader of the country would basically let them come in and take control of the economy. And with money comes control. That's how they did it to Africa. That's how they toppled like the Ottoman Empire and the Mughals in India. That's how they pushed their way into China. Well, on the periphery was Japan. And Japan was paying attention. And the Japanese saw what the Europeans were doing to the Indians, to the Chinese. And you know what they said? I don't want to have that happen to us. And they represent the only civilization on Earth that was not European, that was not conquered during the age of new imperialism. And how did they do it? They are the exception. Now, we left off with Japan, with the emergence of the Tokugawa shogunate. The Tokugawa brought an end to the war of all against all, reunified the country, and established political and economic and military control. The Tokugawa shoguns then maintained isolation. They basically didn't like the Europeans, so they cut Japan kind of like off the map. They passed laws that made it illegal for foreigners to appear. They forbade trade coming in and exports going out. They did everything they could to ban virtually all contact with the outside world. Now, of course, they still maintained Dashima, which was like the Japanese version of Canton. So there was one island. And the Japanese did allow Chinese ships to come in. But they also would allow Dutch. Not the English. Not the Spanish, not the Portuguese. They didn't like any of those people. But the Dutch were okay because, as we said a while ago, the Dutch never pushed religion. So because they weren't pushing religion, the Tokugawa were like, fine, we'll buy your stuff. Plus, the Dutch mostly brought the goods from the Asia Trade Network, stuff that they wanted. So they were all right. Now, the Tokugawa maintained control for 300 years because of the semi-feudal alliance system that they created, which I did talk about previously, where the shogun would have absolute power and he would give lands to family members and daimyo that he trusted. And that if you did not obey the shogun, he could basically take your lands away. They also would end up creating like a bureaucratic system where the daimyo and their alliances would combine their samurai warriors to basically serve as police, and everything was stable. But it would become costly. Why? Well, you had to pay people salaries, particularly the samurai, who didn't work. They weren't like militiamen. The samurai spent their life training and preparing for war. So in order to keep this military force loyal, the daimyo would give samurai control of local villages. And the villagers were supposed to basically feed and house and take care of the local samurai. Thus, you had a system that was stable so long as there wasn't something out of the ordinary. Now, I also said, and just as a reminder, Trey, that's what came in. They didn't have money. Commodities were purchased with food, particularly rice. So, if you're going to pay the samurai at a local level, that means the peasants are giving a portion of their harvests to the samurai. Well, what happens if you have a year where you have bad weather?
Can't pay us.
Well, yeah, you can't pay him. And then what's this guy going to do? The only person in the village who legally can carry weapons.
Start to kill you.
Exactly. So not only could the bad weather impact what's going on in the village, but then expand that. Think of all the villages in the daimyo's land that suddenly are getting less. They're not going to be happy, which means the daimyo is not going to be happy. And then if you have a whole bunch of daimyo happy, what's going to happen with the shogun? So it wasn't a house of cards per se, but the only way this system worked was that if everything was working perfectly. And I know most of you have not been on this earth for many years, but how many days in your life has everything been perfect? Always happens. So, to try to prevent the ups and the downs, the Tokugawa system allowed for the shogun to implement tons of economic controls. Why? Well, again, it's the same reason why our government implemented socialism, beginning back when Woodrow Wilson was president, but particularly during the Great Depression when FDR was president. Because historically, we always had booms and we had busts. So they tried putting barriers on the economy through taxes and regulations to prevent the highs and the highs and the lows and the lows. Well, the Tokugawa would attempt to do the same thing. So, to encourage hard work, taxes could be paid not with cash, but with agriculture. Why? Well, this encouraged the peasants to keep working. Because truth be told, people tend not to cause shenanigans, get into trouble, if they're working. So, you put enough pressure on the poor people, the peasants, and all they're going to do is work. Because we know the unhappy samurai could basically cut their head off at any time. Now, there are instances where labor service could be used. So if you did not grow enough crops to pay your taxes, you basically could become an indentured servant, a debt slave. So you could work for somebody to pay off what was owed. And that was fine too, because roads had to be built, canals had to be dug, you know, walls had to be built. So you could work off your obligations. That was fine. But seeing how most of the population were peasants, this essentially meant that they too were living precariously. Interestingly enough, just like what the Ming did, if you remember that, the shogun would encourage people to make side hustles. They would encourage peasants, if they had a skill or downtime, to actually make stuff. And if you made stuff, you could sell it. And you could make whatever money you could get for it. Like those people that have Etsy pages. So, what ended up happening was you started having peasants that began weaving silk in addition to growing rice, for example. Or maybe on the side they started making soy sauce. Or maybe on the side they brewed sake. Or maybe they made what was called rapeseed oil.
It was called what?
Rapeseed oil. Yeah, it's like a cooking oil. So long story short, you have enough whatever you're growing to be able to make it into something else. So you basically manufacture. So not only could you sell the raw agriculture, but you also could sell whatever you could make out of the agriculture. Now, interestingly enough, some of these farmers became wealthy because they produced items that people wanted to buy. I mean, after all, who doesn't like a little bit of sake every now and then? Not that any of you who are under 21 have any idea what I'm talking about. Because that's an adult beverage. Another area that the shogun allowed? Full-blown artisans. Okay, you have a skill, and you can produce commodities, do that full time. Because after all, they needed clothes, they needed, you know, highly skilled manufactured items, tools, pottery, etc. All of that was handmade. Where is he? There he is, okay. So you made those, you could make money as well. And some daimyo, the wealthiest of the wealthiest, would also go into banking. They would engage in the act of money lending. This is an actual document that lays out terms of a loan that was prepared in 1673. No, but I've read translations. Essentially, the daimyo of Suban province is granting to one of the wealthier peasants in his domain, who was trying to start up a production business, a loan. Now, there were no usury laws. Usury laws are the laws that control banking. So basically, the lender controlled the terms. on this portion of the scroll, it lays out the terms. The borrower did not have to make payments for 6 months because the daimyo was going to give him a chance to take the money and get his business up and running. But after 6 months, he then had to begin payments. He was charged a 75% interest rate. And he had 5 years to pay everything back. And if he did not pay it back in those 5 years, the daimyo would seize not only the business, but his home and all of his lands. Well, don't go, How many of you guys have credit cards? What's the interest rate on those credit cards? 20-something percent. And why are you paying that, which is ridiculous? Well, you need a credit card. If you need money, desperate times call for desperate measures. Now, the one thing I don't know is I don't know if he ever fulfilled the deal. I don't know what happened to him. But the terms are very simple. What do you think mom and dad does when they go and get a mortgage? A mortgage is a loan that you get to buy a house. Because how many of your parents can afford $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 to pay cash for a dwelling? That's what I do. That's what I do on my side hustle. I close mortgages. Well, it is what it is. But all of these things were sanctioned and regulated by the shogun. And so long as everyone was working, so long as everyone was producing, so long as people were making money and buying and selling, everything was okay. There was stability. But at the same time, the Europeans are starting to penetrate the Asian countries. Japan's economy suddenly experiences a downturn. Why? Well, the economy got big too fast. By the 1800s, there was more focus on making and selling than was actual production. They started shifting over to a, I don't want to call it a market-based economy, but it was kind of like that. The problem was, like in a capitalist economy, the winners win and the losers lose. The more successful merchants use their money to begin buying out all the competition. And in many of the provinces, entire sectors of the economy were monopolized by single families. Now, there are pros and cons to monopolies. But me, I personally am a more free market capitalistic guy. I like competition. But there was no competition in Japan. And the consequence was single family would control and conquer market sectors. Well, what happens if something suddenly happens to one of those families? You would lose the complete production cycle of whatever that good was. And if it's something that's needed, your entire economy is threatened. So for instance, what do you think would happen to our economy if Apple or Google went bankrupt? It'd be huge. To make matters worse, not only was production, the buying and selling, monopolized, but so was the distribution. It's kind of like what happens when Walmart moves into a small town. Walmart, because they have access to commodities that can be procured on a global level, and they have so many distribution centers globally, they can buy stuff dirt cheap and sell it dirt cheap. And they can put everybody out of business. So that's what began happening in the cities as well. So again, the threat is, as long as everything's good, this isn't a problem. But when the recession hits, then this all can implode. And lo and behold, it actually happened. Beginning in the spring of 1833, Japan would suffer what they referred to as the Tempo. The Tempo was basically climate change. I know you've all been told since you've been young in that climate change, we're all going to die. The ice cap's going to melt, the seas are going to flood, everything, we're all going to die. Well, truth be told, if you actually look at history, climate has always been changing. It's always been cyclical. There are periods of time when it gets warm, there are times when it gets cold. There are times... Dude, I know you're watching your video. My class, please. I don't even remember what I was saying. Climate change. Temperatures go up, temperatures go down. It gets wet, it gets dry. Their economy is based on agricultural production, which means you need perfect, stable weather. In the spring of 1833, continuing into 34 and 35, it got really hot, it got really dry, and agricultural production plummeted. The consequence, for a series of summers, they would have the worst harvests that they experienced in hundreds of years. And once the dry and hot ended, it suddenly got cold and wet, beginning in 1836. So because you had this sudden shift, they couldn't stabilize things. It's estimated that over those series of years, food production decreased as much as 70%. There are stories that talk about people eating weeds and leaves and straw. They eat anything that's alive. Bugs, birds, lizards, snakes. There were even stories of cannibalism. Because the foundation of the economy had been knocked out, this has a ripple effect throughout the whole country. Japan, by 1837, was in an economic situation that was so dire, it was estimated that if it continued for even another month, the whole country would have imploded. Well, guess what happened? People rioted. In 1836, it's estimated that throughout Japan, there were over 450 peasant uprisings in the countryside. And there were 100 plus riots in the cities. These were not organized. This was not a revolution. This was people saying, I have no food. I have no money. My children are starving. We are literally dying of famine. And no one's doing anything. Now, of course, how long do you think these riots lasted?
Not long.
Why?
They were not as armed.
That's exactly what happened.
So the moment the peasants started protesting, the samurai came out, started killing people until they stopped.
The irony was that if you have the ability to go and look at what the people were protesting, it was not political. They were not protesting against the emperor. They were not protesting against the shogun. What they were doing is they were protesting against the people who had, because they had not. They were going against the wealthy, they were going against the merchants, they were going against the landlords. And what they were asking for was the government to help them. So, most historians look at these protests as being significant. Because what were the masses of the people calling for? Change.
Well, I'll tell you, if you're going to reform a country and the people are willing to embrace change, how hard do you think those reforms are going to be? Why not? Well, they want anything that's different. They'll accept anything,
which makes change possible. So compare that to what we looked at in the Ottoman Empire or the Qing. You know, in China,
yeah, there were people who wanted reform, but there was as many people that didn't want it. The Ottoman Empire, same thing.
And that's the reason why the reform efforts failed. But here, the people want just anything different than what they have, which provides opportunity.
But then that takes us to the question, what type of change are you going to implement?
This is where it gets interesting. Because at the same time, the Tokugawa system was based upon tight control, regulation, maintaining the status quo. During the same period of time, there was an intellectual renaissance of sort that took place in Japan. But not like any other renaissance that has ever occurred elsewhere. Most times, there's demand for change, and there's people thinking about what to do. Typically, those ideas tend to come from the left. More liberal, more progressive ideas. But in Japan, it would come from the right. More traditional, more conservative.
All right. In terms of the social hierarchy,
Japan going back to 500 AD had been highly influenced Am I boring you?
No.
Okay.
Japan had been highly influenced by Chinese thought.
Chinese thought, we know, is rooted in Confucianism. But in the 9th and 10th century in China, during the Song Dynasty, the Chinese kind of went back to basics and kind of reinvented the wheel with Confucian thought. And those ideas came across the Japanese Sea and penetrated Japan. At the goal were the five relationships that we talked about. Filial piety, you know, the belief that someone's superior or inferior, and that you should engage in subordination,
If someone's your better, you bow down to them and you obey them completely because they're better than you.
Well, this was also the Japanese mindset. So,
this system would become entrenched and encouraged.
So, for example, it was believed that you could figure out this behavior by hanging out with your superiors. So, think mentorship. You take a young kid that doesn't know anything about the world. Well, you encourage them to learn from a master. Someone who is knowledgeable, someone who is wise.
And the wise person shows them the ropes.
Exactly, like an apprenticeship. Because the Japanese believe that the young person could learn by observing. Again, the wise master could tell, look, when I was your age, this is the mistakes I made, so don't do it. But within Neo-Confucianism, there also was a hostility towards foreign ideas. Because again, Confucius was the master. He was all-knowing. What else do you have to learn from anybody else? So, you have reverence for obligation, tradition. And this is what the Tokugawa fully embraced.
But in the 18th century, a century before the economy collapsed, Japanese thinkers started saying, is this the best system?
Should we be embracing that system? Because again, Confucianism is Chinese. Neo-Confucianism is an amalgamation to a degree of a little bit of Japanese with a little bit of Chinese. Well, should we emphasize more Chinese thought and de-emphasize traditional Japanese thought? Or maybe we should subvert Chinese thought and increase Japanese thought?
This debate would also get a little political.
Because you had the shogunate, in which on one hand, you had the emperor, who was the divine son of the sun goddess. But the divine son of the sun goddess is not actually our ruler. The ruler is actually the shogun. Well, should we make the emperor more powerful? And depower the shogun? Or should we increase the power of the shogun? Decrease the power of the emperor.
Was this like England with the Episcopal Church and the queen or the king?
Like, yeah, who should be in charge?
Was it about the same time and it was a purely...
No. That debate happened, you know, when Elizabeth, okay, you know, with the emergence of the Puritans. That was in the 16th century.
Okay, so that was before then.
This is after.
Yeah.
This is the 18th century.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with one another because Japan is isolated. But again, all human beings think the same thing.
Yeah, good point. Wow.
So they're having this debate because ultimately they want to make sure that the system they have in place is the best for Japan. Ironically, the reaction to this debate, and again, there were many Japanese thinkers that were writing about this stuff for decades. But eventually this would trigger an intellectual movement that became known as Kokugaku. Kokugaku. Kokugaku loosely translates to national learning. National learning. What we would call nationalism. Essentially, the thinkers in this school of thought, it wasn't an actual school, just school of thought, philosophy, ideology, they basically started saying, you know, maybe the best way to keep us strong, to keep our society stable, is to focus on what they called the Yamamoto Gokuro, which is the Japanese heart. So, maybe instead of this Neo-Confucianist stuff, which is Chinese, maybe instead we should focus on the Japanese stuff, i.e. Shinto. And under Shintoism, the emperor is the divine son of the goddess responsible for creation. So maybe we need Shintoism and thus more emperor. Ironically, what they're doing without realizing it is they're kind of looking at the idea of the Chinese dynastic circle and the mandate of heaven. In other words, the emperor should be supreme. All right. Now, like any idea, there are always people that have other opinions. Around the same time, an alternative to Kokugaku, which focused on the Japanese heart and Japanese tradition, and that would be a school of thought that would become known as Rengaku. Rengaku loosely translates to foreign learning? As I mentioned, Tokugawa Japan isolated itself from the world, except from the Dutch. When the Dutch first came in the 1500s, they were coming in the old small ships of the line. The Dutch sailors were all grimy and gross. But fast forward 150 years, and the Japanese started taking note that the Dutch were advancing in technology. Their ships were getting better, bigger, faster. Their clothing styles changed. And they started saying, what's going on with this? I mean, after all, the Japanese were still living the same lives as they had, as their parents had, their grandparents had, their great-grandparents had, going back through 300 years. Same style of clothing, same style of dress, everything was the same. Same level of technology. So this started the people who subscribed to Rengaku to start saying, okay, we don't like the Chinese. We like the Japanese. But maybe we should allow some stuff to come in. Not the religion, but the technology. Maybe we could learn from these hairy barbarians. Now, ironically, the weirdest thing triggered this. One of the things that the Japanese began asking the Dutch
were for medical knowledge, medical texts. Because Japan was having outbreaks and pandemics like everywhere else. And so the Dutch started bringing them with them books. Because Europe was going through the scientific revolution. They were also experiencing a medical revolution. So they're bringing these books that talk about surgeries and medical treatments, medical medicinal formulations, and, you know, modern advances. Well, the Japanese had been using Chinese medical knowledge, which talked about, you know, balancing the humors and going into trances to, you know, kind of heal yourself holistically. The Japanese are like, well, the Chinese stuff, our people are still dying. But maybe we can use some of this Dutch knowledge. And soon they begin asking for them to bring books. Because when you open up a Western style book and you have anatomy in there that shows what the internal body actually looks like, that's knowledge. Soon books on botany and geography and math and physics, astronomy, metallurgy, ballistics, military tactics, all of the stuff that are appearing in European colleges begin coming to Japan. And the Japanese are like, whoa, what if we take Dutch, combine it with Japan, and we can be better? We can become stronger, not by going to the past, like Kokugaku want, but by going into the future, by combining with the past. So the weird thing is, you had two reform ideological movements that wanted to transform Japan by essentially not rejecting its past, its history, its traditions, but embracing those, but just adding in some better technology. In other words, adaptation. Now, that's not to say that there were not tensions between Kokugaku and Rengaku. There were. Kokugaku, the traditionalists, that was the ideology of many of the more hardcore daimyo. They wanted to revere the emperor. They felt they could strengthen themselves because Japan had already had a warrior culture. And of course, the reformers are like, yeah, you can go on the battlefield with your swords all you want, but give me a firearm. But here's the weird thing. There was no left and the right. There's no progressives and conservatives. Both essentially were conservatives. Because both of them talked about making Japan stronger, protecting Japan, putting Japan first. Majiga. It doesn't flow off like MAGA. We're not making America great again, but we're gonna Majiga, make Japan great again. And how are you gonna make Japan great again? By embracing what makes Japan unique. So, there was no talk about destroying the system, but instead it was going back to the way the system had been before the shogun. So, we're going to revere the emperor. We're going to revere our traditional religious and cultural beliefs. And by doing so, we will become strong. And FYI, understanding this is what's going to allow you to suddenly make sense of why the Japanese suddenly in 1933 decided to trigger a war against China
when it plunged into Manchuria and conquered it. And then, once it absorbed Manchuria in 1939, it would trigger another war with China, which would precipitate in December 7th, 1941, to bombing Pearl Harbor.
Because it's about making Japan strong. And that became their only focus. Never mind this globalism. Never long this collective, let's hold hands and sing kumbaya.
And the emperor, being divine, is a figure worth sacrificing yourself for. Questions? So, take a step back. We have a population ready for change, but they're not going against the government. And now within the government, we have a new possibility. By changing the shogunate.
What happened to the shogunate?
We're gonna get to it.
Okay.
You think I'm gonna leave you hanging on that one, Jane? Come on now. You should know me well enough by now.
Never.
All right, other questions? The only thing that was necessary was a shove. Because before someone is willing to change anything about their lives, something has to happen that pushes people to change. Because change is not natural. And in the case of Japan, what caused the Japanese to decide to transform its society, as it had been for hundreds of years, was the appearance of the foreigner. Because unlike most people who don't pay attention to what's going on in the world, at the same time this is going on, the Japanese are listening. They're hearing from the Dutch. They're hearing from the Chinese of what's going on in the rest of the Asian trade network. They're hearing how the Europeans are making inroads into the Ottoman Empire, and they're impacting the Safavid Empire, and they're pushing into India, and they're taking over Indonesia and the Philippines. And they're literally on the doorstep of the Chinese. They're hearing these things, and they're getting nervous. Proof of this was in 1791, a book was actually published in Japan calling for the creation of a large navy. So that way they could basically use a navy to protect the barbarians from coming to the home islands. But it was never acted upon. Because sometimes people who suddenly come up with a new idea that's different, that's out of the box, sometimes labeled as a crazy person. But the irony was is that 60 years later, the author of the book was proven true. Because guess what happened on July 8th, 1853? America arrived! On July 8th, 1853, Commodore Matthew Perry sailed into Edo Bay, modern Tokyo Bay, with a squadron of 4 American steamships. They still had the masts and sails, but they were powered by a coal-powered steam engine that gave them paddle wheels. This is how the Japanese depicted it. When they saw the smokestack and the black smoke billowing out, they were actually convinced that this demon vessel was powered by a volcano. They had never seen anything like it. Now, the funny thing is that Perry was acting under orders of then President Millard Fillmore. And President Fillmore ordered Perry to essentially go to Japan and make a treaty. 1853, the Second Opium War is in full swing. President Fillmore wants Japan to serve as a coal fueling base and also possible trade, kind of like a leaping point, because he envisioned that once the Second Opium War was over, America would get more rights and privileges in China. Well, for 5 days, diplomatic maneuvering took place. See, Perry had no idea how the Japanese system worked. He didn't know what a shogun was. He didn't know that the shogun had full political and military and economic control over Japan, because his knowledge of monarchy was based on the European model. So that there was a king or an emperor and they had all the power. So he demands, let me meet with the emperor. But of course, the Japanese are like, no, no one meets with the emperor. You meet with the shogun. He's like, no, my orders are to speak to the head of state. Well, the Japanese have a funny way of communicating in circles. If you get to know people who are actually from Japan, they never actually tell you what they think, but rather they lead you down a road to make you think something, which is usually different than when they're actually thinking. So they're sitting there talking in circles. Perry's getting frustrated. It gets so bad in true American style, he threatens that if you don't allow me to meet with the emperor, I am going to sail to that big city over there and I'm going to open fire. I'm going to bombard your city. Which, of course, the Japanese are saying, no, you don't want to do that. That's the shogun's home. You'll only anger the shogun. So please don't attack the shogun's palace. They tried giving him gifts. They tried, you know, other types of things, including women. And Perry's like, no, he didn't want any of that. He wanted to talk to the damn emperor. Well, then, on the fifth day, something unprecedented happened. While the representatives of the shogun are trying to negotiate with Perry, suddenly, two princes arrive. Two of the sons of the emperor. They appear, and they agree to meet Perry on the shores. They kind of ignored the representatives of the shogun, and they promised that they would take the letter from the U.S. president to the emperor. But they're going to take the request under advisement. In other words, we're going to think about it. Perry basically realized, well, if this is as good as I'm going to get now, that's fine. But he did make an interesting reply. Apparently, he told the Japanese that he would be back. Why? Well, again, the president has ordered them to get this island country to be a base because they're in the midst of the Opium War. Perry sails away. 2 months later, before Perry comes back, the shogun Tokugawa Ieyasu died. He had been shogun for 20 years. Now, unfortunately, the shogun had multiple sons. And the shogun's council couldn't decide which son was going to succeed him. So they had a span, of about 2 months where there was no shogun. Well, while they were trying to figure out who's going to be next, the shogun's foreign minister also does something unprecedented.
The whole system was based on the shogun making all of the decisions. But his foreign minister, before the new shogun is appointed, sends a letter out to all of the daimyo, all of the nobles, and asks them, okay, we got this situation. We got this American guy who has this letter from the American president. He wants to talk to the emperor, and he wants access to Japan. What should we do? Well, he then got something that he probably didn't expect. He got responses. Of the 59 most powerful daimyo, and this goes back to the Kogaku and Ranko, 22 said, you know something? We should engage in trade with the Americans. Why? Well, because we don't have a navy. And this is going to allow them to come and they can blow up anything along the coast. So, we should engage in trade, learn their secrets, build up our defenses, and then kick them out. Eighteen of the 59 said, no. We'll let them land and they can get fresh water, but that's about it. Instead, we should focus on building up our defenses until such time as we can kick them out. And then there were 19 hardliners that basically said, why are we going to talk to them at all? We'll just kick them out. We're not going to negotiate with these people. We're going to defend our islands because we are Japanese and we will win. All 59 agreed eventually there would be a war and Japan would win. It was just a matter of time.
Internal law?
Kind of. All right. In November, Tokugawa Aesida was chosen as the new shogun, and then 3 months later, Perry comes back. This time, he doesn't come with his four ships. No, 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 no. This time, he comes back with a bigger fleet. He has 8 ships. And then, based on the responses of the daimyo, most of which said, well, we should do something, because the minority said, no, we should just fight. And of course, the concessions are not making permanent friendship. No, no, no. It's only temporary until we can take what we need to fight them off. So, what ends up happening? Well, very simple. They would open 2 ports to American trade. And they would allow the Americans to get provisions. So you can get fresh water, if you need wood or whatever it is to fix your ship, that's fine. You can get food. And we'll allow you to open up a consulate. So you could have a U.S. official in these 2 ports. That's fine. Not a full-blown unequal treaty. And again, in the Japanese mind, this is only temporary. Well, the problem is, just like what happened in China, the moment the United States makes the deal, everyone else jumps on it as well. And so before long, the shogun makes 4 treaties with these foreign barbarians. Now, of course, there's a debate. What the heck are we doing? Why are we doing this? What's the long game? Well, truth be told, we have to be fair. To these questions, the shogunate basically replied, we don't have an alternative situation, solution here. One, they have steam-powered vessels that have guns capable of shooting explosives
5 miles into the interior. At this point, in the 1850s, they're still using muzzle-loaded firearms, but they're rifled. So they have spiral grooves, which means instead of shooting just powder and balls, they're shooting what's called mini caps, mini balls, which kind of look like little bullets. And it's no more flint muskets, but they're percussion caps, which basically means you pull the trigger and boom, it fires. Accurate, long range. They also have other technology. So the Shogunate basically said, if all of the European powers were to unite and come, look at what they did to China. And two, more and more people in the Shogunate sphere of circles was embracing Rengoku. Rengoku. Let's let these foreign ideas in. Let's learn from the barbarians. Let's embrace their technology. But here's the kicker. There was one person in particular that was outraged by this. The emperor. But did the emperor's opinion matter? Well, yes and no. Politically, he is not in charge. Instead, he's more like the Pope. But is the Pope influential? Why was the emperor not pleased? Well, he was anti-foreign. He believed there was nothing that could be learned by the barbarians because the barbarians are inferior. And the moment the emperor opened his mouth, all of the daimyo that were divided, particularly the hardliners that just wanted to fight outright, suddenly said, oh, well, we don't have to listen to this guy. We don't like what he's saying. We could go right to the emperor. And if we could get the emperor to make a command, all Japanese are bound to obey. Questions? Well, this sudden realization is ultimately what triggered the revolution, which the Japanese refer to as the Bakumatsu. This simply means end of the shogunate. From 1853 until the final collapse in 1868, the powers of the Tokugawa slowly began to subside as more and more daimyo looked to the emperor as the true leader of Japan, the traditional leader of Japan. Of course, the arrival of the foreigners exacerbated this. Due to the concessions, you could actually have Europeans walking around in two Japanese port cities. And these Americans, and English, and Dutch, and Russians, they didn't know Japanese. They didn't know the culture. They didn't know the little subtleties of the Japanese personality. You know how easy it is to insult a foreigner? If you go to another country and you act like a stupid American, it's real easy to do. And the only one to blame is you. Why are you going to go to a foreign land and expect them to accept Americanism? And by the way, what would you do if you came into a foreigner and they insulted something about America?
not know the difference.
You can be mad at them, but they don't know any better.
Yeah.
So, you had Europeans and Americans acting like Europeans and Americans, and you had the Japanese getting pissed.
And why were they getting angry? Well, because the Europeans were doing the same... let me rephrase that. They wanted to do the same thing in Japan that they were doing elsewhere around the world. Opening up economic relations, giving them more and more influence, more and more control.
So, 2 years after the first treaties are negotiated, the American consul, Townsend Harris, would, after the Second Opium War ends, decided, well, look at what we did to the Chinese. The Japanese are essentially like the Chinese. We did the Tientsin treaties. Well, we should start doing that here as well. We should look for extraterritorial rights. We should look for more ports. We should allow ministers to go into the interior. Well, the consul contacts the shogunate and says, let's redo our deal. Now what? The whole idea of allowing them in was just to give them a little bit, just enough so they go away. Now they want more? Isida was still young. He was in his early 20s. He didn't have the experience of his father, who had been shogun for 20 years. He's hearing all of these things from all of his advisors. He's hearing different things from the daimyo. He just doesn't know what to do. So, he once again does something that's unprecedented. He would send some of his advisors to go to Kyoto and ask the emperor, what should we do about this? By the way, this was the first time any Tokugawa, any, going all the way back to Tokugawa Ieyasu, that ever consulted with the emperor. This point, I think there's been 16 shoguns for 200 plus odd years. Not a single one asked a single emperor a single question. There's a danger, though, in asking a question. And what do you think the danger to asking a question is?
Getting the answer.
Getting the answer.
The emperor says no deal.
But, after hearing from the emperor, the shogun decides to do something different. I'm going to sign the deal. Because what's worse, an angry emperor or an army with guns and artillery? You think so? Well, talk about a Hobbesian choice.
Both are...
Neither's good. Neither is good.
But he figured he would do the one that would save him. But by doing so, what he would essentially do is end isolation.
So, think of what's in the Tientsin Treaty, because that's basically what got negotiated. We now have multiple ports that are going to be open in Japan. We now have the ability to have consuls in all of those cities. They also have the ability to put troops in there if necessary.
Wow.
You also are allowing Christian ministers to travel anywhere in Japan.
And extraterritorial rights.
If an American does something stupid in Japan, he is to be arrested, turned over to the American consulate, and he will be tried under American law, not Japanese.
Well, when he does this, this would set off a wildfire. Because what do you think the daimyo are going to do when they find out he asked the emperor gave an answer, and he did different than what the emperor said? All right, we'll find out what happens next class. Now, just to warn you, next exam will probably be next week. We're almost done with Japan. We're done with Japan. That's exam three. So if you've missed any classes, all the lectures except for Tuesday and today are on the website. Get what you've missed. Your papers are coming up as well. They are due Tuesday, April 22nd. Your papers are worth 20% of your grade.